Accession number 21116, Reel 3.
The Nuzzle Reel 3.
The four battalions for the brigade was the 1st Battalion of the Border Regiment, 1st Battalion of the Royal Ulster Rifles, 2nd Battalion South Staffs, 2nd Battalion Ox and Bucks. And we was spread down the country. I don't know where about because we never met the others at that time, but we was in Wallingarden City, and we was Wallingarden City at a time when they had the fire blitz on London. I had been on leave to Halifax. At one point I must make, I missed a bit out that while I was in Bud-on-Tyne, I got married. I came down on leave and I got married. I had 48 hour leave to get married. I actually was late getting back, and I was charged with being absent without leave. The fact that I couldn't get back because of no train didn't matter. But I got the only punishment in the army. I got 7 days CB, confined to barracks. That's the only, in all my service, that's the only punishment I got. So, Wallingarden City. I'd been on leave from Wallingarden City. Coming back on a Sunday night, the train went into King Cross Station. And as we got into King Cross Station, middle of the night, the firebomb raid was in full go. The military police grabbed all the troops, pushed it down the tubes. So we were down, sheltering down the tube. And then when the fire blitz got bad, we were dragged out of the tubes, given a half-filled sandbag to go out to swap fire bombs. There was incendiary bombs were coming down all over the place. We shot at the incendiaries, and then in between they kept sprinkling us with HE. When the HE started coming, we had to go down into the shelters again. So we spent the entire night down the shelter, up the shelter, swatting bombs. We got absolutely covered muck, soot, and the following morning went back to the unit, back to Wallingarden City, just up the line, and my suit was ruined. I had to be equipped with a new outfit again. We then moved from Wallingarden City up to the east coast, in Norfolk, bottom of Norfolk. The battalion was on duty on the beaches. They had base on the beaches. We was in a building. B Echelon was in a building about 3-4 miles from the coast. All I was doing there was repairing the vehicles. The vehicles need repair. They was guarding the coast. Occasionally we had a bomber came over, but not much. We then was uprooted again and we moved into South Wales. And that's when all the battalions came together, the four battalions of this independent brigade, we came together into Wales. Our battalion was went into Glanusk Park on the Usk River. Just about 2 miles from a village called Crickowell. We then were turned into, we had started training then to be mountain troops. The plot was that we were going to train as mountain troops and go into Greece. And we got mules shipped into us and muleteers. The muleteers were Punjabis. The mules were just mules. We then had to, it was rather queer because they had horses, and the horses were Northwest Mounted Police horses. They had a brand stamped on the hoof, the back hoof. Beautiful horses for the officers. But the men had to march behind the mules. And mules were to learn to pack the hampers, the panniers really, were made of wicker. With two of them, you had to pack them with exactly the same weight because the mule was much more intelligent than we were, and he knew in a flash if there was more weight on the right than the left, he used to pitch it off. He used to walk from behind, put him over, get the girth strap, tightening it. Mules, most horrible animal I've ever met. While you tighten the strap and he used to look at you and smile or sneer. And as soon as he got it tight, it'd breathe out, and the thing would slide round. So I was taught then by the Punjabi how to make sure. You tighten the girth, and when the thing looked round it and smiled, you kicked it in the stomach, and it went, and you tightened it another two notches. Very effective. Brutal, but effective. The Punjabi did it all the time. And then we started to train in the Brecon Beacons. And we went all around following them. Now, you must realise that mules eat grass, and they suffer from flatulence. And we always had to march behind them. Oh, God, it was awful. The muleteer was in front, dragging the mule, and we're marching behind him. And, oh, it was deadly. And they say mules, sure-footed a mule, they're not. They fall off hillsides. We lost several, fall off the beatings. And they roll down, break the legs. All the equipment, all their panniers get smashed. We're searching through the hillside looking for machine gun parts and things which shoot the mules. One little thing, I will say, it probably erase it after. The funniest thing that happened in that time was up this here on this hedge, and it was only wide enough for a mule unpacked. In fact, the mule feet was very close to the edge because the back. Muleteer is pulling the is leading the mule. We're following. The mule stops, stubborn as a mule. It just stopped and refused to go any further. He pulled, we pushed, wouldn't move. So he then climbed under the mule to the back, and he had a very large thumbnail, and he lifted the mule's tail and he stuck his thumb up the mule's backside and gouged. That mule was off. Then when the humour came out again, one of our blokes said, "We're only going to catch that mule if somebody sticks his thumb up that muleteer's arse." Anyway, that is army humour. It's a passing the time. Anyway, we eventually, there was almost, in the spare time, when we wasn't actually training with the mules, we was training the Home Guard. In South Wales, every pit town, every pit village had its company of Home Guard. And there was mostly young men, because the young men were still working in the pits. And the rivalry was very keen between the platoons and the companies, and because every village came from a different spot, deep rivalry. And we was training these people, and we used to go on exercise, and we used to do the enemy for them. And by this time, I had been made sergeant. I'd come through Lance Corporal, and I was now the fitter sergeant with the 1st Battalion in South Wales. And we just had a thing given to us, bulleted blanks. A Ben gun is an automatic weapon, but it works by gas coming from the, as the bullet goes up, the gas follows it, goes down through a drilling in the barrel, it then works a piston to the rear, and it brings the empty case out and allows a new round to go in. So you can't fire a blank. An ordinary blank is just a bullet with the end crimped up. When you fire it, it goes bang and it simply opens the crimp. But there's no gas to operate the Ben gun, so you couldn't use a Ben gun. So they brought the bulleted blank, and it had a wooden bullet painted red. And these would travel about 30 yards, no more. But it was enough to make the gun, make the machine gun work. And we was out. I was with the B echelon, and the quartermaster who was in charge of B echelon had gone away from somewhere, so I was finished up with the senior member there. So I was the senior of the B echelon section that was there, and we was at the bottom of a pit, not the pit, of the hill. The spoil from the pits is made into a huge heap, quite big, and was at the bottom of this thing, and we put scouts out all the way about for observing. And one came down and said, "There's a company of Home Guard forming up over top of this slag heap," that's the name of it, "and they're going to attack over the slag heap." So I put the two Ben guns on one on each flank, and they came over the top screaming and shouting and bawling, coming down with a bayonet fixed. We let them get about halfway down, and I gave the fire, and the brains opened. And of course, firing about 30 yards, a wooden bullet, and the slag heap being quite soft, it was puffing up, the bullet were puffing up in front of them. Well, clear of them, but it was puffing up. And the people running down suddenly saw this coming up, thought it was firing live ammunition, and they started to stop. They tried to stop, but the people behind were pushing them down. And then they finally turned around and ran back up again. And a lot of them threw their rifles away. So we picked up the rifles, and when we got back into our camp, we took them up to the nearest company we had and handed these rifles over. They wasn't their rifles, they came from another company. And they were very, very pleased to have them, because they made the other unit parade into their village to collect them. A real put down for them. Mind you, if I'd have been coming down that hill thinking it was exercise and I'd seen the puffs, I should have probably stopped as well. You know, it's funny, but it wasn't funny at the time to the Home Guard. Anyway, we eventually then moved from there down to, where was it? We went to Berryport, a little place called Berryport on the coast. Llanelli was the battalion headquarters when Llanelli. We was at Berryport, and a little place near to Berryport on the road, that's where motor transport. And they then was acting on the beach. They had positions on the beach to repel invasions, and they had to go through a minefield to get to them. We had a transport on the other side. Once again, funny things happen. We had a night exercise. The motor transport was doing night exercise. And of course, I'm at the back one. The vehicle, Vitters always travel at the back of the convoy. And we set out, and it was at night, and we're going to do a night convoy around South Wales. We had no maps, so we just followed the vehicle in front. They had little lights that shone onto the back axle. The back axle was painted white, so these little small lights underneath shone onto the axle to give us an idea where the vehicle in front was, without showing light to enemy aircraft. And so we used to look for these lights and follow them. We came out, we turned right, and I'm following the truck in front of me, and we're going so far and stopping, going so far and stopping, going so far and stopping. We went right up the hills, right away round, came right away bound, and we came back onto the same road as we come off, coming from the opposite direction. So the vehicle in front of me turned into the camp, and I turned into the camp. And when they got in the camp, there was only our two vehicles there. The chap in front of me had been following a bus, and it was a circular bus from Llanelli around the villages, and we'd gone right away around these villages and come back into the camp. The rest of the unit didn't get back till about midday the following day. It was rather funny. The chap driving the truck in front got a real blasting. But that is what happens in wartime. Nothing goes according to plan. 1941, we're at this time now in 1941, and we then get told that there is a new thing, they're going to start glider troops. And they've already had parachutists, the parachutists have been trained, but we started to form glider troops. And the people who are going to form the glider troops, and they're going to be the first air landing brigade, was our brigade for 1st Battalion Border Regiment, 1st RUR, 2nd South Staff, 2nd Oxen Bucks. It was supposed to be voluntary. It's supposed to be a volunteer. They were very, very cunning where they said it. They didn't say all volunteers. They said those who don't want to go into gliders, see your platoon sergeant in the morning. But of course, most of them been around so long, we was a team. I'm very great friends with them, regimental association, And we finished up. There was very few of the border regiment didn't go with us. And I think that's the same with both other regiments. The brigade moved. The three battalions went into onto Salisbury Plain. They went to Beaufort Hutt Camp in that area. The border regiment went to Barton Stacey, which is a camp about 7 miles from Andover. Barton Stacey camp. Quite a big camp. It had A, B, C and D camps. But we was there in one of the camps. There was RE depot was in the other camp. I know they were split up. And then we started training. Now, with no gliders, and so we started really hard toughening up training. We was out before breakfast. We started off by doing a 6 mile walk. Then it became a run and walk. Then it became a run. Then it became run two telegraph poles, walk one telegraph pole. Then we started putting kit on us. Before we did it in PT kit, and we was really hard training. We gradually built up till we were doing these run and walks. I've never been as fit in my life. I was really fit. We also made it. For instance, we in Barton Stacey camp, if you came out of the camp, there was Barton Stacey village, and there was a stream, a trout stream, and the bridge went over the trout stream to go into Barton Stacey village. Well, when we came out, we never went over the bridge. We always went down into the stream and went under the bridge and came up the other side. So by the time you went out, you was wet through up to the waist. You was out all morning exercise. You came back at lunchtime. If we came back at lunchtime, you came back, went down under the bridge, come out. You then that was wet through again. So then you changed. You had your lunch. You changed into another set of denims. You hung your denims in the drying room. And you went out in the afternoon, down in the river, through the bridge, up at the top, and out again. So we was constantly wet through. It was not good, but at least it toughened you up. We started to get all kinds of queer, funny weapons. Anything new came out, it was issued to the airborne div for user trials. We got all kinds of queer things that came out. One of them was the Baker-like grenade. Previously, the 36 grenade was, which was, I think it was also called a Mills bomb in the First World War. The 36 grenade was our grenade. It was vicious, insofar as you couldn't throw it far enough to get away from the bits that flew out of it. So you could only throw it from behind cover. So you had to stand behind a wall or somewhere, because if you didn't, you were liable to kill yourself. The Germans had a much better idea. They had their grenade was a potato masher. It's like a big bean can on a stick. Now, that bean can is only thin metal like a bean can. So you could fire it, and all it did was a blast, the very little shrapnel. If they wanted shrapnel, they had a cast iron jacket that fit over it, marked off like bars of chocolate in segments. And of course, when that was on it, then it became a dangerous grenade. So the Germans could attack you in the dark, throwing their blast grenades just in front of them. And if you've got bangs going off under your feet, it tends to make you think. But we couldn't do the same to them, because our grenades, if we'd have thrown them, was liable to kill our own people. So they brought out a Bakelite grenade. It was not as big an ordinary grenade. It made a Bakelite. They said there was only three pieces of metal in it: a spring, a striker, and the detonator. And when it exploded, the actual Bakelite went into powder, more or less. And we had 62 sergeants and sergeant majors in the regiment at that time, because we got anti-tank guns, six-pounder anti-tank guns too. So besides being infantry, we also had six-pounder anti-tanks as part of the battalion, a separate unit, a separate company running that heavy weapons. So we had this exhibition of this grenade, and our weapons sergeant actually threw one into the pit. It exploded, and the only bit that the only three metal bits of metal, one came out and hit him. which everybody thought was hilarious. Everybody was in hysterics, being at the bloke who said it was quite safe to throw, getting the only bit that came up. We got Sten guns. The Mark I Sten gun was more dangerous than anything I've ever met in my life. There's no safety catch on it. A Sten gun operates on a blowback. When a round is fired, the bullet goes out the front, and the pressure being equal and opposite, it blows the large block backwards. This in turn extracts the old case, and as it goes forward under a spring, it puts another round in. So that it works. Now, if you banged it on the ground at the butt, that breech block would come down far enough to take a round into the breech. Not only did it in a breech, it fired it. Only fired one round, because immediately it fired, the block went back and locked, so you had to trigger to get another round. But if you banged it, you could fire one round. And this has happened a lot. I spoke to many people, and they have had the same trouble. Bang everything, it went bang, and a round came out. So they then went on to made a safety on it. They drilled a hole through it, and they had a piece of metal which went through into the casing. So when you knocked it in, it locked the block, so it didn't move backwards and forwards. Then we got the silenced one. We got all the equipment of silenced weapon. Now, it wasn't a very good silenced weapon. The sound, the explosion, it had a big padded cell around it, so the actual gas went through like a, just like silencer on a car. It did take the sound back, but it didn't stop, and it wasn't silent. This great big block of metal, so it went backwards and forwards, you fired it. You didn't hear the doing, but you could hear clang, 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 clang as this thing were going backwards and forwards. Once again, useless as a silent weapon. They did make them eventually. They made other ones which had a retarded, which you could, instead of coming back with a clang, they had a retarded. Gases opted it to come down slowly, but that was a different weapon to get the silenced automatic. We eventually got the Mark 5 and Mark 6, which were very good Stens. They had wooden butts and a wooden foregrip. In fact, I've got a photograph of them somewhere. But they was really excellent weapons. You could aim them. You could aim them, which you couldn't do with the early Marks. We did Has it gone again?
No, carry on.
We went on an exercise down to on the coast. Wait one. You can delete that card if you want.
No, okay, just correct it.
Right. The place exercise went to was Ilfracombe on the coast. Each battalion went down in turn of the four in the brigade. We went down there, we did training on cliff climbing. We did training or assault training over the tops. They went out on a navy, had a small boat, which took us out to under the cliff. They had a projector to fire a grapple. They had a climber. The navy fired a grapple up to the cliff, on top of the cliff, made sure it was tight, and then we had to climb up the cliff. The rope was knotted to make it easier for us. We had the kit on. We'd kit on, we'd steel helmets on, gas masks in the alert position, with rifles, with hobnail boots, with the lot, and it was heavy. And we had to climb this cliff. It wasn't a sheer cliff, but it was a cliff, and we walked up it with our feet walking up the cliff, and we're walking up the rope. We then got to the top. When we got to the top, we did exercise. An exercise which finished up by walking through part of a reservoir with the water up to your waist. Unless you were small people, then they were up to the neck. And then finished up with our firing range and fired. And it was quite a heavy day. It was a very heavy day, a full day. And it's a good job we were fit, or we couldn't have done it. I broke two ribs on the climb. And I think about the third day I was climbing, I was last man off out of the boat, and I'm climbing the cliff, and as I put my right foot down, a piece crumbled off. And with it crumbling off, I simply swung round on the rope and went into a cliff, and a sharp edge went up under my arm into the ribs, and it bust me two ribs. I felt them go, the crack, and also felt the pain. And I was, you know, pain was such that I let go, and I came down the cliff. Luckily, it was deep water underneath it. Luckily, the boat had pulled out, otherwise I'd have been wearing it. The boat pulled out, and I whistled down and went into the water. I went down. It was deep. I couldn't push off the bottom, because there's no bottom. I couldn't reach the bottom. So all I did was slow down, and then I seemed to hover. And I'm desperately trying to swim to the surface. I wasn't making much go of it, and I did swallow water. And next thing I knew, I was in the boat, and they had me over at one of the the things that go across. They had me over it, pumping me up and down in it, pumping water out of me. They fetched me out of the boat up, they'd seen me come down. And when they did eventually floated up, I was unconscious, and they brought me out on the boat up, and they pumped the water out of me. And I went sick, and the treatment in those days was put big elastic plaster all the way around you. Nowadays they don't do that, but in those days they put it round, and about 3 inch wide, all the way around your chest, right from top to bottom. Made it difficult to breathe, really. I was excused 3 days duty. Before the end of the exercise, they had me up the rope again, which was a bit painful. Then then on coming back, going down on this exercise, the anti-tank gun, one of the anti-tank guns towing behind the Jeep, we got the Jeeps by this time, one of the anti-tanks towing by the Jeep, had turned over on a rope coming down with a cliff side at one side. And it, as it turned over, it had a stop on it, so it couldn't go out completely, but it turned over, and it took hold of the Jeep, and it turned the Jeep over. And the three blokes in the Jeep were killed. So we had to modify the things so that if the gun turned over after that, it wouldn't turn the Jeep over. You could do that by grinding off some lugs on it. But we lost three people killed there. We then did a forced march back to our camps, which is quite a long way from the coast to Hampshire. And the forced march is a halt every 2 hours, a 10-minute halt in them days. We were doing 10-minute halt every 2 hours, and we were marching through night as well. We had ambulances following us up. People who collapsed were picked up by ambulances. Got back into the camp, we were told we could go to bed, and when you woke up, you went down to cookhouse and ate. I was very sore at that time. Bopped the rib at that march. I had blisters everywhere. But we got back all right. I mentioned Jeeps. I must break off and mention the Jeeps. We got a signal before this time. We got a signal saying that we send somebody up to Liverpool to pick up some vehicles from America. We went up. I went up there, being the fitter sergeant, and these things were Jeeps, but they wasn't Jeeps. They didn't call them Jeeps. They was made by the Banta Motor Car Company of America, but they were the forerunner of the Jeeps. They were slightly longer for the existing Jeep, and it wasn't. They actually designed them. They made them, but Willys and Ford got contracts to make them in bulk. So everybody thinks them as being Willys Jeeps or Ford Jeeps. But the people who made them were Banta Motor Car Company. We motored back to camp. Now, we still hadn't got the gliders, but we had mock-ups of the gliders, of the big glider, the one we were going to put the Jeeps in. And it was simply a mock-up of it, the same size as and we had to practice putting the Jeep in and out of the thing. We found we couldn't get it in. It was slightly too long. But we got over that by cutting off the corners of the wings, both fore and aft, so we could actually shortened it for the turn. So we could got it in. Eventually the Jeep came out, the Jeep was much shorter, and so it made it much, much easier for us. We had been doing glider training by this time. Originally,